worship the King, all glorious above, and gratefully sing His wonderful love. Our shield and defender, the Ancient of Days, pavilioned in splendor and girded with praise. Oh, tell of His might and sing of His grace, whose robe is the light, whose canopy space, His chariots of wrath a deep thunder clouds form, and dark is His path on wings of the storm. Thy bountiful care, what tongue can recite? It breathes in the air, it shines in the light. It streams from the hills, it descends to the plain, and sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. Frail children of dust, and feeble as frail, in Thee do we trust, nor find Thee to fail. Thy mercies how tender, how firm to the end, our Maker, Defender, Redeemer, and Friend.
We're so happy to be fellowshipping here with you folks this morning. And I want you to turn to the book of Malachi. I think I probably have told this before, but it fits this morning. Mark Twain once wrote an essay on heaven. And he said in that essay that he didn't know much about heaven. And that was an understatement for Mark Twain. He was a cynic, an unbeliever. And he said the only thing he knows about heaven is what he hears Christians talk about. And the conclusion he's formed is that heaven is going to be an unending church service. Now he said the problem with that is that these Christians who want so badly to go there can't stand more than about an hour of that a week. And so he doesn't know why in the world they'd want to go to a place where they would do something like that forever. Now the people that Malachi was writing to were people like that. They had grown weary of serving the Lord. They had become indifferent. They had become apathetic. And yet they were expecting great things from God. And the story sort of fits. Now Malachi is the last call of the Old Testament before the voice of prophecy is silenced for 400 years. And so that makes us wonder, what would God's last word be before 400 years of silence? Well, the people had been returned from captivity for about 100 years, and the temple had been completed for about 55 years. The wall had been standing, it was completed about 10-15 years, and the people were actually under the Persians, enjoying political and religious freedom. They basically had everything they wanted except perhaps their independence. But they had not returned to God with their whole hearts. Now, the captivity cured them of idolatry. You don't read after this that the Jewish people ever lapsed into idolatry. The captivity totally cured them of that. But it did not cure them of their half-heartedness in relation to God. And so Malachi's appeal, passionate appeal in this little book, is for them to repent and return in wholehearted devotion to God. And He promised them, if they repented, that God would bless them. And He gave them a stern warning if they refused to return. Now, He confronts two things in this little book. He confronts formalism, which was the beginning of Phariseeism. And He confronts skepticism, which was the beginning of the liberals, the Sadducees. Now, both of these cause people to argue against God. Formalism does not want to be disturbed, and skepticism does not want to be disproved. And so he was up against a real task to preach to these people. Now, there had been certain promises made by Haggai and Zechariah, and it had been 100 years since they had prophesied. And 100 years is a long time. I mean, that's half the life of our nation. 100 years ago, President McKinley, Taft or Roosevelt would have been president. That seems like a long time, doesn't it? Well, it was a long time. And there were promises made. I'm sorry, Edsel, did I make a mistake? It was Woodrow Wilson. Okay. I was getting close. All right, there were certain promises made by those prophets 100 years ago. Let me read them. I am with you, saith the Lord. From this day I will bless you. Yes, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations will come, and I will fill this house with glory. And it hadn't happened for 100 years. In fact, it wasn't really to happen for 500 years. You know, one of the things that wears Christian people down is the long delay. But it did happen after 500 years. And God had promised Eve a Savior, and it happened after 4,000 years. God doesn't measure time the way we do. And He is expecting us to continue to believe through that delay. But the hopes of these people had been dashed by the delay. And their response to God was calloused and insulting. And the prophet uses an interesting technique to give his message. He delivers 7 indictments against the nation, and then these people respond with insult and innocence. Well, we didn't know we were doing that. And so that's the method he uses to get his message across. But the problem throughout this entire book is the failure of God's people, in quotes, to understand and respond to divine love. And so this will be our outline for this morning. The title of the message is Love in Question. And when we conclude the book, I want us all to think seriously. Is our love for God in question? My belief is, if it is, it doesn't exist. Because that's what God says here. If your love for God is in question, if the people around you aren't quite sure where your love is focused, then it isn't focused on God. So, love in question. Love protested. Love profaned. Love perverted. Love purified. Now don't get nervous. I'm not going to spend 20 minutes on each of these. Love precluded. There was something standing in the way. 3, 6 to 12. And finally, love prosecuted. Or in other words, carried out to completion. So those will be our 6 points, and we'll try to move as quickly as we can through them. Love protested. Let's read verses 1 through 5. First of all, we don't know any more about Malachi than what you read in that first statement, which means we don't know anything about him except that he was a prophet that had a burden and a word from the Lord. Verse 2. I have loved you, saith the Lord, yet you say, wherein hast thou loved us? And this is God's answer. Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord, yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste, for the dragons of the wilderness. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down. And they shall call them, and they shall call them the border of wickedness, and the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. And your eyes shall see, and ye shall say, the Lord will be magnified from the border of Israel. Now, I have loved you is a summary of the whole history of the covenant. It was very clear from their history that God had loved them. Just their very survival, when other nations had come and gone that were much greater than they were and had much more power and much more clout. In fact, in secular history, there just isn't an awful lot recorded about this little nation. And so their whole history is a proof that God had a special love for them. Now, the recent proof, you could go back through their whole history, their deliverance from Egypt and all of those wonderful miracles He did. I was just reading this week about the fall of Jericho. You could go back, but just in the recent history of these people, both Edom and Israel had been destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 B.C. Israel was able to come back and rebuild. The Edomites, the descendants of Esau, had tried to do so and had not been able to. The Nabataeans, which were the desert dwellers to the south of them, kept coming and destroying as fast as they rebuilt. And they never got their nation rebuilt. And God is saying, you're asking, how do we know that you loved us? And here you are with a rebuilt temple and walls around your city and the favor of the Persians. And here's this other nation that God did not choose to bless. In fact, He's not going to let them ever rebuild. And the evidence is right there before your eyes. But this unfailing love of God, as it still is, was met by appalling failure of the lives of these people. They looked at every hardship they were having as somehow an evidence of an unloving God. You know, that's what happens. A lover looks for evidences of love and finds them. A person who's not a lover looks for evidence of negative attitudes and finds them. It depends on what you're looking for. You see, the Christian doesn't see and believe. He believes and then he sees. He believes in the love of God and he finds abundant evidence of that love. We heard it expressed this morning in some of the testimonies, and that's only a fraction of what happened this week in our congregation if the whole story were to be told. And so, they protested. We don't see any evidence that God loves us. Look at all the trouble we have and these promises that this temple would be filled with His glory. That hasn't happened. And all of the things that Haggai and Zechariah said, it's been 100 years and we don't see it. All right. Love profane. Let's read from verse 6 to 2, verse 9. A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If I then be a father, where's my honor? And if I be a master, where's my fear, saith the Lord of hosts unto you? O priests that despise my name, and you say, wherein have we despised thy name? And this is God's answer. Ye offer polluted bread upon mine altar, and ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. And if you offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if you offer the lame and the sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts? And now I pray you beseech God that he will be gracious unto us. This has been by your means. Will he regard your persons, saith the Lord of hosts? Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for naught? Neither do you kindle fire on the altar for naught. I have no pleasure in you, saith the Lord of hosts. Neither will I accept an offering at your hand. For from the rising of the sun even to the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And in every place incense and incense shall be offered unto my name, and a pure offering for my name. And my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye have profaned it, in that you say, the table of the Lord is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. Ye said also, behold what a weariness it is, and ye snuffed at it. In other words, turned up your nose, saith the Lord of hosts. And ye brought that which was torn and lame and sick, thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand, saith the Lord? But cursed be the deceiver, which hath in his flock a male and voweth, and then sacrifices unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen. And now, O ye priests, this commandment is given for you. If ye will not hear, and if ye will not lay it to heart, to give glory unto my name, saith the Lord of hosts, I will even send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yea, I have cursed them already, because ye do not lay it to heart. Behold, I will corrupt your seed and spread dung upon your faces, even the dung of your solemn feasts, and one shall take you away with it. And ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him of life and peace. I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name. Now here's what a priest is supposed to do. The law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn many away from iniquity. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law in his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But ye are departed out of the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all people, according as ye have not kept my ways, but have been partial in the law. Well, these people say we didn't say that. We didn't say that we despised your name. Well, you don't have to say it. It's what you do that says it. And he says, you may not have said those words, but that's what your actions prove what you really believe. You would not give such gifts to the governor of Persia. And he says, so contemptible is your worship of me. In other words, you keep all the best for yourself and you give me the leftovers. It'd be better not to worship at all. Who has the courage to go and shut the temple and put out the fire? And just close the whole thing down. I was wondering this morning what would happen if God would reveal to every place of worship this morning where the truth was really being presented and practiced and taught by the leaders of the congregations. If God would reveal where that is not happening and every door where that's not happening would be nailed shut this morning, I wonder how many churches would be open. That's what he's saying. And he says, this is your attitude toward me. And even the Gentiles someday are going to worship me from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same. And, you know, that's a beautiful thought. The world turns and somewhere there are Christian Gentiles praising God and worshiping around the world all the time. And he said, the Gentiles are going to do that. And you think you're a special people. And then he says, the priests are at fault. It's the leaders that get people into trouble. Because they teach what's wrong. I meet people at the Franklin County Jail who, when they hear what the Bible says about divorce and remarriage, they say, some of them have said, I'm divorced and remarried 2 or 3 times, and I've gone to church every Sunday of my life, and I never was told that it was wrong. If I had been told it was wrong, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I had no clue. Now, I think that's a little bit flaky. I think there's something in everybody's heart that knows that's wrong. But they can say that because there was no preacher that told them that. The distinction between females and males. Most of the women in most of the churches are there this morning with slacks on. And many of them are there with blue jeans on. Women in leadership. Homosexuality. I say to my friends, when I was growing up, the popular conservative churches stood for some things for one generation. And then the next generation, they compromised. In my generation, they did it with the theater. They did it with the dance. They did it with card playing. And I could have think and women wearing dresses. That was fought for a little while. And then they surrendered. And I say, your churches will do it also with homosexuality. And they say, oh, God forbid. Well, this is interesting. The last issue of the U.S. News and World Report that carried the news, you know, they quit carrying the news, but when they still were carrying the news, there was a survey done of the young people in conservative churches out there. And lo and behold, 51% of them said the church should accept homosexuality. That's the next generation that I've been saying will accept it. That they say, God forbid. There are four essentials of priesthood. There are four essentials of spiritual leadership. The law of truth has to be in his mouth. Uncompromisingly. He has to know what the truth is. It has to be an unchanging reality that he consistently, throughout his entire ministry, teaches without any compromise. There can be no unrighteousness in his lips. He must walk in peace. I'm taking this right from this passage. He must walk in peace and equity. He must treat all people equitably and peaceably. And he must turn many from iniquity. That's his task. But it says that you people, the leaders, are the ones who corrupted the nation. And it's happening right before our eyes. It's the leadership of this nation, the spiritual leadership of the masses of Christians in this country that have laid down their responsibility and have made the compromises. Or we wouldn't be in the shape we're in. Now, in the book of Amos, Amos was inveighing against people who were keeping a perfect ritual as some kind of an insurance policy to cover the rest of their sins. Well, this is even worse. Now they don't even take the worship seriously. They don't even keep the ritual. They don't even bring perfect animals. They don't even do any of that now. And it says the priests are the worst offenders. Worship is a passion toward God as number one priority in all of life. That's what worship is. We talk about spending quality time with our children. That's good. Do you spend quality time with God? Do you give quality time for God? I'm afraid too much of my experience through my life has been giving marginal time. The time I had left over from my other responsibilities. But worship says the most important thing in life is God. And all of the actions demonstrate that. That's what worship is. Because as I've told you many times here, the word worship is the old English word worth-ship. It's the thing to which you ascribe the most worth. And that's always shown by the way you act. It's where your number one passion is. And I repeat what I've often said. Every person has a dominating passion in his life that dominates all his other passions. And if that is not God, then it's not true worship. That has to be God. I do not believe in passionless religion. I believe that a person's number one passion, if he's truly worshiping, is God. And he says here, if you give the second and third best to God, why would you? No wonder you don't see his love. Why would you expect him to do any different to you than what you're doing to him? And he says, Your priests are going to be the object of contempt. And that's exactly how the clergy of our day is basically regarded by the public, with contempt. Because I think that people have a general impression that they are not doing what they're supposed to be doing, and they somehow are falling down in their responsibility and are hypocritical in their service to the Lord. Well, that's the second indictment. The third indictment is found in verses 10 through 16. Let's read those. Have we not all one Father? Hath not God created us? Why do we deal treacherously every man against his brother? By profaning the covenant of our fathers. Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, the master and the scholar, out of the tabernacles of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto the Lord of hosts. And this have ye done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, and with crying out, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering any more, or receiveth it with goodwill at your hand. Yet ye say, whereto? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion, and the wife of thy covenant. And did not he make one? Yet he had the residue of the Spirit. And wherefore one? That he might seek a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For the Lord the God of Israel saith that he hateth divorce. That's the word. He hateth divorce. For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that you deal not treacherously. So this indictment is that God does not regard your offering with goodwill. And they say, why? And he says, because you have dealt treacherously with the wife of your youth. Now apparently what was happening here is these people had come back to the land, and there were already people living in the land that had sort of claimed the land. And they didn't have any claim, particularly on the land. And so what they were doing, now this is just a surmise, what they likely were doing was they were leaving their wives, which they brought back with them, and marrying some local woman that had the right to a certain piece of land. That's a possibility. And he said, and he generalizes this, he says this is symptomatic of unfaithfulness in human relationships. And it's the kiss of death for any society to have unfaithfulness in human relationships. Marriage is the fundamental social bond that holds all society together. And God knew that. He permitted divorce in the Old Testament, but he surrounded it with a whole pile of rules and restrictions to make sure it did not get out of hand. One wonders that he allowed it to begin with. But then he did restrict it. It's not restricted today. It's no-fault divorce. And when I was a boy growing up, this began in our churches. I remember a day when it wasn't so. I remember when the whole thing started. And the people who led it. And I could name them. It's sad. Some of them were conservative leaders that I had trusted. And all of a sudden they caved into this horrible social evil that was coming on the church. And here was the statement. We have to be redemptive. Now, 50 years later, I'm saying to myself, what in the world did they redeem? They didn't redeem the aggrieved spouse. I'm talking now about the children. I mean, the general society. They didn't redeem the aggrieved spouse. They didn't redeem the children. They didn't redeem the church. And they didn't redeem society. You tell me what got redeemed. Nothing. The exact opposite occurred. And you can tell this makes me pretty upset. We've ruined a whole society because preachers could not continue to tell the message right. It's a matter of easy convenience. When men abandon their covenants with each other, they quickly abandon their covenant with God. That's just the way it is. And this is the only way that God can raise up a godly seed, which is very important to Him. It's not going to happen. With all this broken and messed up relationships, there is not going to be a godly seed. I'm sorry. It will only be those who have kept the faithfulness of their covenants with their brothers and sisters and their wife. Faithfulness in all relationships is the mortar that holds all of society together. And this is one of the most horrible evils that has ever happened to the society of our country. And it just, like I said, I can't believe it. I can't believe it that the churches got on the bandwagon and helped to drive the thing to where it has gotten to be. God help us. And it says it very clearly here. God hates it, and it tells why He hates it. Because it's unfaithfulness to the covenants between human beings. It will not permit a godly seed. And it will destroy His relationship with the people who are involved in it. Love purified. Let's read verses 17 through chapter 3, verse 5. Ye have wearied the Lord with your words. Yet you say, wherein have we wearied Him? When you say, every one that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them, or where is the God of judgment? Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek shall suddenly come to His temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. They wanted this to happen. He shall come, saith the Lord of hosts, but who may abide the day of His coming, and who will stand when He appeareth? For He is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap. And He shall sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver, and He shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. And I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be swift witness against the sorcerers and the adulterers and the false swearers and the oppressed, those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the fatherless, that turn aside the stranger from his right and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts. Love purified. Well, they say, how have we wearied God? And he says, and they also say, no, and he says, the way you've wearied God is you've done something pretty terrible. You've started calling bad good and good bad. And you're saying, that must be the way it is because look at all these bad people living around us and they're prospering more than we are. There is no God of judgment. And he says, yes, there is. There is. And you're looking for the appearance of the Messiah. But I want you to understand that when He comes, it will not be well with you. God has not confused good or evil. It doesn't matter if the whole society has confused good and evil. That never happened with God. Soap purifies and fire eliminates, and God will do both. The sorcerers are people who play on superstition and the desires of people for their advantage. Adulterers are licentious people who make a mockery of faithfulness. And oppressors are those who exploit the weak and the disadvantaged. When evil cannot be contained, it is essential that there be a lone voice like this man that has enough courage to stand up and continue to declare what is good and what is evil. God says, I have not changed. You know, I look back on my youth, and I think, what makes these people think God has changed? It used to be commonly understood. When I went to public school, I went the whole way through grade one, from grade 1 to grade 12. And I don't recall, in fact, I'm almost positive this was the case. And this was public school in the 1950s and early 1960s. I don't recall that I went to school with one student or had one student in the schools where I went who was from a home that was broken. I don't recall that I did. In fact, divorce and remarriage was unknown. There was one man in the community who was divorced and remarried, and he was looked upon as a shady character by the whole community, not just for the Christians. And there are just many other things like that. And I say to myself, what makes them think God has changed? He hasn't changed. They have changed. They're calling evil good and good evil, and the preachers are doing it. That's the sad part. You know, you can get used to the dark. Most of you probably had the experience of going into a restaurant. People like to eat in dimly lighted places. I guess they're afraid of what they're eating or something. I don't know. But anyway, you go in there and it's dark. You can't see anything. But if you sit there for a while, you can see. And you get used to it. And it seems normal. And that's what's happened. It seems normal. The dark seems normal. But it's still dark. And he says, God's going to purify. I mean, God hasn't changed. He is going to eventually bring this back to the place where it's supposed to be, and then worship will be true worship again. All right, the next one. Love precluded. Something standing in the way of love. Let's read it. Verse 6. For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed. I like that statement. He says, it's because I made a covenant with you people. And it's only because I'm faithful to my covenant that you're still here. If I would be like you, you'd be consumed. I would have reneged on my covenant. Even from the days of your fathers, ye are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But you said, wherein shall we return? Well, will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts, and all nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. So he says, return unto me. I haven't changed. My covenant is still the same. And they say, how shall we return? And he says, by a simple thing of giving God his due with your possessions. The problem with these people, and it's the problem with us today if we're not careful, they believed they were owners of their possessions. There's not an owner on this earth of anything that's here. It all belongs to God. And we somehow can't keep it in our minds that we are stewards. We're only taking care of God's property. That's all we're doing. There are no earnings possible without God. My strength, my wisdom, the opportunities, the country in which I live, the laws that enable my purchases, all of those things are in the hands of God, and without them, there are people today who have worked much harder than anybody here has worked all week and have nothing to eat. And somehow we get the idea it's our management. It's our strength. It's our skill. It's our deed that we're holding in our hands. It doesn't belong to us. It's all God's. And God says, if you'll give it to me, if you'll give me my due, I will bless you. Now, maybe in this age, we're not talking as much about physical possessions as we are here in the Old Testament. But I want you to turn to a passage. We are talking about blessings. Would you turn to Luke chapter 16? This This is my favorite parable about the dishonest steward, and we're not going to go through all of that. We're just going to take out the lesson, which says in verse 8, "And the Lord commended the unjust steward," not God, not Christ, but his master, "commended him." He basically said, the guy is a scoundrel, but boy, he's a clever one. And he gave him credit for it. And he says, "For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. He that is faithful in that which is least," which is money or possessions, "is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in least is unjust also in much." Now listen to this. "If therefore ye have not been faithful," and we're talking about stewards, "if ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches?" And I take that to be spiritual gifts, just like in the parable of the talents. And the Lord says, look, you're a steward. If I gave you possessions, which is the least in my estimation of value, and you didn't know how to take care of that, I'm not going to give you anything valuable. If I gave you the ability to do the things you'd like to do spiritually, you would just do the same thing you did with money. You'd use it to appropriate attention to yourself and the pride that we talked about this morning. So the way you handle your possessions is a test. And God looks at that and then decides whether he's going to give you anything worth more than that. That's what he says. Isn't that what he says? Verse 11, "If therefore ye have not been faithful in that which is in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit your trust to true riches? And if ye have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own?" That's interesting. Apparently spiritual gifts belong more to you than what the possessions do. "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." And so even though this probably has a spiritual application, God is still looking at the way we handle our stewardship when he divvies out his gifts. And I think that in itself explains the spiritual poverty of many people. A self-made man has little faith. He doesn't need any faith. He can do it himself. But the other thing that's true is he doesn't receive much either. He's got to do it all himself. Generosity brings rich blessings in every way. All right? And he says, bring your tithes into the storehouse and I'll open up a blessing for you. The windows of heaven will open up and you will not be able to receive it. And all nations will say, this is a delightsome land. Well, let's do the last part. Love prosecuted. Verse 13. "Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet you say, what have we spoken so much against God, against thee? Ye have said it is..." Here's what it is. "You said it is vain to serve the Lord. And what profit is it that we have kept his ordinance and that we have walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts?" I would just like to insert there, that was part of the problem. They were walking mournfully. Even in the Old Testament, it says, if you do what God tells you, it'll be well with you. Serve the Lord with gladness. But see, it was a burden to them. "And now we call the proud happy, yea, that they that work wickedness are set up, yea, that they that tempt the Lord are even delivered. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day, when I make up my jewels. And I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth not. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember..." Now these are the very last words of this book. "Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now his indictment is, your words have been stout against me. And they say, well, what have we said so much against thee? And he says, well, it's your cynical attitude. You look around and you say, the proud man prospers. The wicked get along better than the righteous. And even those who shake their fist at God are delivered. Tell me what benefit we have for all our mournful, onerous, difficult, burdensome worship. It doesn't pay. Well, he says, there is a group of people that don't have that attitude. They have a genuine reverence for God. And when he appears, they will be revealed. You know, Jesus said one time to the Pharisees, he said, the reason why you cannot see me for who I am, and I could go through the difficulties you'd have had seeing that. I mean, there were things about Jesus' life that would have been very difficult for a certain mindset to ever get a hold of, that he was God, that he was the Messiah. It didn't add up to a certain mentality. But he said, The real reason why you're having trouble is not because your theology is a little difficult. The real reason you can't get it is because you never knew God. The person who knows God gets through all the difficulties, all the things that confuse everybody else, all the things that cause other people to stumble, and they land right in the middle of God's truth. And I'll name you some of them that had the same set of circumstances confronting them and the same information and the same situations and questions. And here they are. Zechariah, Elizabeth, Joseph, Mary, Simeon, Anna. They were these people. They never swerved from what is right and what was wrong, according to what God had said. And they had a reverence for God. They had a reverence for what he had to say. They obeyed him, and they loved him, and they were devoted to him. Anna spent all her time in the temple. And when Jesus came, it was as clear as could be to them, even right at his birth. God is not absent. I know that his second coming has been delayed way longer than anybody expected it to be, and it may be delayed even longer. But he is not absent. He is present. He is present, and he is observing how you respond to him. And my question this morning is your love for Christ in question? Those practical things in your life, the details of your life, the decisions you made in this past week about the things that you're involved in, would all of them demonstrate to the person looking on that Jesus is number one? Or would it be the convenient accommodation and compromise of what I call liberalism? You know, I never could understand the liberal mindset, but I think what it is they don't ever see beyond the present. They have their ideas based pretty much on what they want and what they think will prosper them and what will be the best for them right now. As Peter says, they are blind and cannot see afar off. That is the biblical definition, by the way, of blindness. They can't see the end and the trend. I ask you, have you continued to nurture in your life a passion for God and everything he represents? And everything he has said, and that is number one in your life. That's the question. Life must be directed by knowledge of good and evil in faith and action. And a knowledge of God creates this polarity between evil and good. Lose the knowledge of God and it all becomes fuzzy. Just look at our society. It all becomes fuzzy, even in the churches, as soon as you lose the knowledge of God. Moral absolutes are abandoned for a series of ethical compromises. And decisions are based on personal success and benefit and the immediate situation. The pursuit of evil seems to bring immediate and rich rewards. And it is celebrated as emancipation. Although men find it convenient to forget the difference between good and evil, God doesn't forget. And God's love will be prosecuted toward those who fear His name, and everything else will be destroyed. Chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, the last two verses of the book, summarizes the message of all the prophets. It mentions Moses, who was intended as a gift leading to fullness of life with God's description of what life was supposed to be. That it may be well with you. I one time in one of the Bibles I had underlined that phrase every time it occurred in the New Testament. It's over and over. Do this, do this, do all, don't neglect any of it, that it may be well with you. But society tends to become degenerate. And the link between the generations gets broken. And by the way, for the young people and children who are sitting here, that is a tragic thing. When the link between the generations becomes broken. Because your parents, you do not see the total picture. Your parents don't either. But they see a lot more of it than you do. And it's God's will for that link to be strong so they can pass on to you what they have learned. And when that link is broken, all of society deteriorates. Moses established the norms of life in relationship with God. The prophets were constantly there calling people back to that norm. And they still, talked about prophets the other Sunday in Sunday school. Yes, they're still here. There are still people around that say, now wait a minute. God has not changed. Here is what He said, and it's still the same. That's the prophet. They are the conscience of the nation, calling it back to its first and true relationship. The passage ends with a curse. And it would still be there. The curse would still be upon humanity. But Jesus came. And He brought the Old Testament to completion and fulfillment. Like Moses, Jesus shows the possibilities of life lived in covenant relationship with God. And that's why in this congregation we have focused so much on gazing upon the person of Christ. He shows us all the possibilities of life when it's lived in proper relationship with God. And it's a beautiful thing. And like Elijah, Jesus calls us back from the false ways that seem so right but are so wrong. The promise of the law and the message of the prophets gave new meaning to the Gentiles and new strength to the generations. But the ending challenge of this message is your love in question? You might want to ask the people who work with you. You might want to ask your family. Do I have a passion for Jesus? Can you see it? That's a very important question. It must be the number one passion seen in all your actions. That's an ideal. It might not always happen quite that way, but it should be very obvious to everybody looking on that you're ready to make a sacrifice with your decisions because of your passion for Jesus. Shall we bow our heads for a word of prayer, and then we'll have a concluding song.